This is another edition of Building the Future with Dan Rundy. It's a privilege and an honor to have General Kip Ward with us. Thank you, General, for being with us. We're going to be talking about Africa. We're going to be talking about security. We're going to talk about development. We're going to talk about his public service career. General Ward, thanks for being here.
My pleasure to be here. Dan, thanks for inviting me.
So General Ward, how did you end up in the military?
Well, I'm a product of the 70s, and so Vietnam. Ah. And going to college in those days, if you wanted to stay in college, you enrolled in ROTC. Otherwise, you were draft eligible. And so when I entered Morgan State University in 1967, I enrolled in ROTC for 2 years. And then past that 2 years, Vietnam's still going on. So in order to stay in school, I enrolled for my final 2 years at Morgan in ROTC. And I received a scholarship, so I had an active duty obligation upon graduation. I graduated from Morgan, and just prior to graduating, I received my commission as a second lieutenant in the regular Army. I was a distinguished military graduate, commissioned in the infantry, and I was assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division.
Oh, my word.
So you recall in 1971, Nixon stopped sending combat forces to Vietnam. So being an infantry combat officer, I didn't go to Vietnam. I went to Fort Bragg and started jumping out of airplanes.
Oh, wow.
But with an obligation of 4 years, my plan was, okay, well, I'll do my four-year obligation, get out of the Army, and I plan to go to law school. Well, as my wife says, you know, that 4 years that we talked about when we graduated from Morgan turned into 4 decades of service.
And wow.
So that's how it got started, and that's how the journey continued for four decades over a myriad assignments around the world, doing things I never imagined I would be doing at the time I graduated in 1971.
So General, you had a number of interesting assignments where you intersected between security and development. One of them is you were asked to serve as commander of the U.S. Africa Command. How did that happen, and what was that like? Were you the first head of the U.S. Africa Command?
I was the inaugural commander of the United States Africa Command. And how it happened is a great question. It kind of reminds me of a question I was asked by President George W. Bush when I was nominated, or when I was appointed to be the U.S. Security Coordinator to Israel and the Palestinian Authority. I was in the Oval Office, we were talking, he looked at me and said, Kip, how did you get selected for this job? I think the culminating piece of myriad assignments that I had prior to standing up AFRICOM led to my being selected to, in fact, stand up to command. I had spent time in Egypt as the chief of our security cooperation office there.
It's a big job.
Big job, big program. I had spent time in Bosnia as the NATO commander of the stabilization force.
Big job.
Big job. And I had spent time in Israel as the U.S. security coordinator, working with the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority.
Big job.
And in each of those assignments, I had been exposed to parts of our government doing things to promote peace other than the Department of Defense, which I was a part of.
Okay.
In Egypt, working as a part of the country team there in the embassy. Obviously, in Bosnia, working with the European Union predominantly, but at the same time, working very closely with the EU High Commissioner, Patty Ashdown, good friend who recently passed away.
Yeah.
Saddened to hear that. But working closely with him, then obviously working in Israel as well with Jim Wolfenson, who was doing some of the economic development pieces as I was doing the security pieces. And so it became very apparent to me that what I did required the support, collaboration with, coordination with these other elements of government that working together side by side to bring stability to a region. When I went to UCOM, initially as UCOM's deputy commander, prior to commanding AFRICOM, I also got additional experience in working with our embassies in the various parts of the European continent, but also in that part of Africa that European command had responsibility for. So when the time came to stand up U.S. Africa Command, with this notion of an interagency construct of sorts, those things weren't new to me, and in fact, I was a champion of that sort of arrangement to ensure that what we were doing was even more relevant, more cohesive, more coordinated in support of our overall national security, policy objectives for the United States of America.
And General, when you were the inaugural commander of the U.S. Africa Command, what were some of the issues that were in the inbox?
Well, the big one was to create this interagency command such that, one, our interagency partners weren't threatened by our being involved, and not that we were looking to do their work, but we were looking to ensure that what we did, and the term that I would use, at a minimum, do no harm, but where possible, let's add value to this complementary effort that we're trying to undertake. We're all, and I would point to my left shoulder, or maybe it was my right shoulder, I had the U.S. flag, said we're all citizens of the United States of America. And that is so. It's not about the Department of Defense, AFRICOM,
or AID, or State Department.
Competing with you, we wanted to support AID, State Department. And so one of the competing things that were prevalent at the time, or how we cause this interagency to receive the command in a way that made sense for all of us, not just for securing DOD objectives, but also for helping to enhance their ability to secure their own agency objectives on behalf of the American people.
Obviously, there have been a series of ongoing, let's call them pain points on the African continent. I would assume that you saw a number of conflicts that were even being driven by a variety of issues that were political, or they've been driven by issues of lack of jobs, or there were sort of some of these basic, kind of the bases of conflict. Where there must have been some of the things that came up.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, we took our basic mission requirements from our national security objectives.
So
the things that we were doing in the command were in support of our national security objectives, closely coordinate with the Department of State. Obviously, you know, the political considerations, our policy perspectives were at the center point of what we would do to ensure that we were aligned. And so when you looked at the continent of Africa and the various challenges that were present, but also opportunities.
Big opportunities.
Present, how could we cause, one, understanding those challenges, what is it should we do as a DOD element to help reduce those challenges, but at the same time, what do we do as a DOD element to help ensure that what we do is synchronized with, is coordinated with, and in fact enhancing what's being done across other parts of our government. So when you look at that space, be it illegal trafficking of drugs, people, weapons, you look at the
animal parts.
Exactly right. No, the hunting, the poaching. Those sorts of things. You look at the governance issues that led to instability because of civic space being cut off and how that created inconsistency and turmoil in the population. When you look at the economic aspects of what went on with respect to not being able to have a decent way of life, living in a decent way, you know, making enough money, earning enough wages such that they could clothe their children and send them to school. A lot of places on the continent, you know, pay for basic education. And so all of these things were there, and the root of instability found its way from many sources. Food insecurity, land encroachment, all these things were there, as well as some historical tensions, cross-border tensions, tribal issues. So all those factors were at play. Folks who were in power as leaders who, for whatever reason, didn't want to give up that power. And so you didn't have those things with respect to governance working, participating in a process such that the government represented the people. We know it most often in the form of elections. But those things, when they weren't working in a way that caused people to feel as if their needs were being satisfied and met, or someone was abusing them, led to conflict. And across the continent, North Africa, Southern Africa, East Africa, West Africa, and Central Africa were all present, from Joseph Kony running through the jungles with the Lord's Resistance Army.
In Uganda,
to what was going on in Nigeria and in the Sahel with those insurgencies, to what was going on in North Africa, and obviously in South Africa with respect to issues of governance what was happening with Mugabe, to also what was going on in other parts of the continent. And so these were all things contributing to tensions, contributing to conflict, contributing to instability. And from the AFRICOM point of view, how could we, As we engaged with our African partners and friends, as we worked with our interagency colleagues, caused what we did to create an environment to help bring stability to those troubled regions, but as importantly, where stability existed so that it could be maintained and enhanced. And so we faced these things across these challenges across the continent, and we worked every day really, really hard to build relationships, to build an attitude amongst our partners that they indeed were responsible for their own security, that we weren't going to be doing it for them, but we were there to support and to help. And that support and help was found in the form of our engagement, our partnering activities, et cetera. Where there were things going on that required some use of force, where that was coordinated and deemed from a national policy perspective to be appropriate, then we were, of course, in place to do that as well.
How, talk about your day-to-day relationship. Did you have an international development attaché attached to your command?
Yeah. One of the very unique aspects of the command that thankfully continues today, for me to know what development should be, would be, I needed someone that understood it. Sure. Obviously, as a soldier and the command, that's not what we grew up doing. And so we created the command with the notion that let's bring aboard in our construct developmental experts, diplomatic experts. And so we created a construct whereby the command had two deputies. So I had a deputy to the commander for military operations who was a uniformed officer. But I also had a deputy to the commander, and during those years we called for civil military activities, which was an ambassador. And in addition to that ambassador, the senior developmental advisor was also a position that we established in order to have someone in the command at a senior position, that when that person spoke, folks paid attention and listened, because firstly, with how we established it, and secondly, I empowered them to do so, or her. And so we did have a senior developmental advisor that was assigned to the command from U.S. Agency for International Development.
Who had the first CivMil role as your deputy?
That was Ambassador Mary Yates.
Okay, and what did she do? What did she go on to do afterwards?
I met Mary initially. We worked together. She was the foreign policy advisor at UCOM.
Oh, right.
When I was the deputy commander at UCOM prior to standing up AFRICOM. And so she and I had worked together. She knew how I thought because of the relationship.
Yeah.
I knew how she thought. And so when it came time to select that person, for me, she was a natural choice. And she stayed with me and the command for about 2 years. And she left that position, and she came back to Washington, and then she was on the National Security Council.
Oh, wow.
As a presidential assistant for Africa policy.
Wow, those are big jobs.
Big job.
When you think about opportunities in Africa, I think about the fact that there is a growing middle class.
Mm-hmm.
It's urbanizing.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the 50 or so African countries are full-on democracies. About
mm-hmm.
16 of them are full democracies. I'm sure you experienced that Africa is a very diverse continent. That oftentimes I think many Americans, obviously folks who are listening to this podcast aren't going to be in this category, but I think the Africa gets a bad media rap sometimes, that oftentimes in the sort of the Western press, it's all bad news all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
I don't know what your reaction to that
yeah.
is.
Well, certainly that's the reaction that we get a lot. Not the case. I would come back here and speak to groups and talk about Africa as a continent, not a country. I mean, this is a continent comprised of, at that time, 53 independent sovereign nations, looking at the continent of Africa and its Indian Ocean island nations, all considered part of the African continent. And in that mix of 53 nations, 850-some dialects, diverse, a great degree of distinction between the subregions, and even within the subregions, more distinction. And so you would go to a particular country and you face one dynamic, and to think that you would see that same dynamic even in its neighbor country, let alone in a different region, was something totally taking you down the wrong path. So a lot of differences because of culture, history, language, colonial experiences.
Yes.
All that contributed to this rich differences, those that you saw on the continent of Africa amongst the various countries. And so when we went to the countries during our engagement and building relationships, we needed to pay attention to that and understand that. To go there and assume that what I faced 2 days ago in country X, I'm going to be seeing the same dynamic here in country Y, false start. And so we spent a lot of time paying attention to that. We even brought into the command something that was, at the time, very unique, cultural anthropologists, to help us understand. And when I brought that to the front of the, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, we need to understand folks that we're dealing with. Because we go in there with our mindset, our perspective, and try to have them do things that support our objectives than theirs. From our point of view,
it's not going to work.
Shaky ground. It will not work.
That is fascinating. And tell me about how was the Africa Command largely a welcome presence in the continent?
It was. Now, we had to work at that. Because you may recall back in the early days, 2000 and late 6, early 2007, the perception was that
we're going to militarize
the continent,
quote unquote.
That's right. Bring in squadrons and battalions and ships and tanks and whatnot. And so we had to do a lot of work to dispel that. And we spent a lot of time, my deputies, other senior members of the staff, as well as our troop formations that we had doing exercises, dispelling this notion that now we are there to militarize the continent. And so initially, the welcome mat wasn't out. The good news is the reception mat was out because we could at least go in and talk about what we were going to do. And we followed that up with action. And so I was told on many occasions, about 16 months into the command, General, what you said is what we see you doing. And so from that point forward, you know, the confidence in what we were doing, the faith in that what we were doing was what we would say we would do, steadily increased to the point where today the command is well received. But we receive a lot of compliments from those who were around in the early days, how hard we worked to create that and to reverse what was never the intent, but as it was perceived to be a militarization of the continent.
Let me ask you a couple questions about China, for example. When you ran the command, was China a presence on the continent?
China was present on the continent.
And was it a security presence?
It was more of a developmental presence. They were pursuing economic interests, their need for resources. They were pursuing that as their main goal during my time.
In my simplistic way of thinking, I'm a simple guy in many ways, and I've always thought that China has a transactional relationship with Africa, and what they, you know, I'm going to be a little bit simplistic here, but it's almost as if they want to stick a giant straw into the continent rocks and agriculture and oil and gas and forest products, et cetera. And so the 90% of what drives their engagement in the continent is that. But you've seen they have a port in Djibouti, a military port, and there's also some discussion about Kenya. As well. How should the U.S. think about this?
Well, the Belt and Road piece that the Chinese have put in still, they want to link
Eurasia
that's exactly
plus.
Right. And it's all to satisfy their purposes.
Think of them as giant straws.
That's exactly right.
Right. You know,
markets, access to resources, getting resources, et cetera, et cetera. And so they clearly have that in mind as their intent. We can't compete directly with that because we don't do business that way.
Now,
we don't go to the continent with suitcases of money and build things that really aren't supportive of helping the people nor the economies and just do it in a very non-transparent way.
And right. Uganda last year, I think it was last year, and there's a giant hydroelectric dam that the Chinese built, and it's got a big crack in it. So the president of the country is not happy about that. And so there's all sorts of issues about transparency and quality. You have to wonder if they're following the Marquis of Queensberry rules of of contracting and what
right.
exactly is transpiring and
right.
with whom. And That's so there's exactly a little bit right. of that. I mean,
That's
I think
right.
there's a lot of that. And so I do think that I do think, General, I don't know if you that we need to be us, but we need to be present in the continent economically, yeah, and developmentally. Sure. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. As I said, we can't compete with them
in that way.
In that way,
because it's not us.
It's not us. But what we do for our role in the continent is to bring activities, markets that are enduring, sustaining, transparent, legitimate, and that make sense for the people, and come with a quality that only we bring to that scenario. And if we were there doing that, we would be the partner of choice in those endeavors.
Yeah, we should be the partner of choice. We have to show up.
We have to show up.
Now, you demonstrated that and modeled that but when you were the head of the U.S. Africa Command by showing up, making commitments, and following through on them. We have to be able to do that on the economic and development side as well.
Exactly, exactly.
How should we think about a couple of some of the – let me just go through some of the hot spots. There's a lot of problems in Nigeria right now. Nigeria is a rich country with a lot of capable people. I don't know if it's 200 million people. It's an enormous country. It's going to double in size.
About 2050.
Why is the – what is the root of that conflict, General?
It is rooted from my perspective, and again, this is now having been away from it for a bit, but it's rooted in a couple of things. The land, like many sources of conflict on the continent, rooted in land, access to land, rooted in the ability or maybe inability of the central government to reach the outskirts of its territorial boundaries and borders to cause those people to feel as if their government is also doing things on their behalf, providing security that's adequate, providing security that's legitimate and transparent, such that the people feel safe where they are, which is the responsibility of the state
to do that.
That's what
government's supposed to do, that.
To do that. And so when you have these things, correction, when you don't have these things, those other negative forces will come into an environment and take advantage of populations and the lack of what should be there to care for its people. So in the case of northern Nigeria, the greater Sahel region, those are the sorts of things that are going on now. You have environmental factors from food insecurity to problems with water to farmers and shepherders and herders competing for land as we have environmental changes that have taken place. So this dynamic and then it is at work in Nigeria still today. It was present when I was in command, and it's a situation just continues.
Let me just a couple of other hot spots. South Sudan. South Sudan got it. The United States spent a lot of blood and treasure, a lot of prestige to get South Sudan its own country.
Right.
Why? What the heck happened there?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great to fully understand? But it's really sad. It's just such a catastrophe.
It's a catastrophe.
Because of what happened in South Sudan, to your point, U.S. invested a lot of treasure in helping South Sudan secure its independence from Sudan. And with the conflict that exists, the internal conflict between the peoples of South Sudan, the factions, and the inability of the leaders to work together for the common good of the South Sudanese people, has led to where we are today, and it's an absolute shame and catastrophe.
It breaks my heart.
Yeah.
Tell me, I was in Eritrea. Did you ever visit Eritrea as Africa Man?
Because of our policy relationship, I didn't.
You know? Yeah, it was very interesting. I looked at the issue of the third largest number of people leaving Africa across the Mediterranean are technically Eritreans. I'll put that in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way I understand it, this is my simple understanding of this, is that Eritrea's got 4 million people and Ethiopia's got 80 million people.
Yeah.
And they fought two wars. The second one makes you want to go full peacenik. They fought over a couple of rocks in a one-horse town and 100,000 people died. And you just want to pull your hair out and say, this is the craziest thing.
Crazy.
Shameful. You know, the shameful amount of spilling of blood for you can't even find it on a map, this town and a couple of rocks.
Crazy.
It's crazy. So because of all of that, Eritrea has a fully militarized society, as you know, General. And so if you're a male in Eritrea and you turn 18, from the age of 18 to 50, you're in theory a conscript of the Eritrean army. And I think my guess is after year six or year seven, you say, look, I've kind of given at the office. And I think I've done my patriotic duty. I think I'm going to take off. And so some people leave. In addition, there's been a little bit of a pull factor because UNHCR, which is sort of like the global referee of who gets to be a refugee and who doesn't, put out a bulletin in 2011 and another one a couple years later saying if an Eritrean knocks on your door and says they're Eritrean, you got to treat them like a refugee according to international law. So there's been a little bit of a pull.
Right.
Well, as you know, the Horn of Africa is a big place and it's pretty diverse. So every South Sudanese, every Ethiopian, every Djiboutian, every Somali, none of them have sort of this special, you know, license from the UNHCR, but the Eritreans do. So when you show up in Italy, you say, well, I'm Eritrean. So they've got like the equivalent of Trivial Pursuit questions where they're like, well, who played third base on the Eritrean World Series championship team last year? You know, or some pop culture question that only an Eritrean would know. And so you've got this pull factor and this push factor. And so my thought was, if you could get peace, and again, one last thing, General, but it seems like as if because of Black Hawk Down and what happened in Somalia, the United States said, you know what, that was such a painful experience, and Ethiopia is a pretty reliable partner, and we're going to really partner strongly with the Ethiopians in the Horn of Africa. And so if we can, you know, they're going to be our primary partner, and we're going to do what we can to help them on a whole number of things. And in return, we're going to be a reliable diplomatic partner on a number of different fronts, if I can put it. This is in a simple terms.
Right.
But the problem with Eritrea, my thought was if you could get peace in our time between Eritrea and Ethiopia, that would kind of create a domino effect of a whole bunch of other things that would go into place where you wouldn't need full-on military conscription from the age of 18 to 50 in Eritrea, and then people wouldn't cross the Mediterranean.
No,
you know what I'm talking about, right? So they've got this prime minister in Ethiopia, I can't pronounce, Abiy.
Yeah.
He's like the guy we've been waiting for 30 years.
Right.
This guy's out of central casting. This is like the dream prime minister of Ethiopia. He flew to Eritrea.
A couple times
now. Yeah. We may have peace in our time.
Yeah.
Eritrea is not the Vienna Boys Choir. It's kind of run by it's a fairly authoritarian place. But frankly, most of the Horn of African governments, as far as I can tell, are fairly authoritarian. Seems like Eritrea, if they could get peace in their time, couldn't we? I mean, I just look at the strategic location of Eritrea and think to myself, they got two ports.
Right.
They're 20 miles from across the Red Sea from the Saudi Arabia. They've got 700 kilometers of coastline. Heck, they're like, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from Israel from the North Point. I mean, it's just it's strategically located. We had a CIA listening base that's in the public domain from the 40s to the 70s when Eritrea was part of Ethiopia. Okay, so you know, I keep thinking that if there was peace in our time, we could this would be a time to cut a deal with the Eritreans and get a military base on there. What's your reaction to that?
Well, firstly, I absolutely concur, you know, with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia coming in and reaching out, and that's a wonderful, wonderful development, and I am excited about it. I think it has all kinds of positive potential
for the larger
for the horn,
yep,
for the continent to be sure.
This guy is a big deal. This person's going to be a big positive change agent. Let's just hope he doesn't get hurt.
Right.
I worry about that.
Yeah. Well. So as Eritrea continues its normalized relationship with Ethiopia and vice versa, as Eritrea continues to do things that its people see are supporting their
interests. Yeah.
The propensity to leave, even with the current government, will be reduced. And the thing that I see as so critical,
meaning young people leaving, as we were talking
exactly
about, right?
Is such that the in place power doesn't feel that it's threatened as time moves on. And that's where we have to be careful.
That the Ethiopians aren't going to march on Asmara tomorrow.
Exactly right. So that will, I think, produce an environment that over time, won't happen overnight, but over time will lead to a more stable horn where Eritrea, as a stabilizing part of that country, of the continent, because he is at peace with his neighbors,
right?
In particular, Ethiopia. You know, Djibouti is already, that's okay. So that will create, in my mind's eye, a scenario that is in our national interest to continue to promote and reinforce. In 1997, I believe it was, I was the assistant division commander in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And I hosted a visit to Fort Bragg of Eritreans and Ethiopians to visit the 82nd Airborne Division. And
a year before their war.
And this was
This was Eritrean military, Ethiopian military.
Correct. Together partners and together and just, it was the type of thing that you say, hey, these are the sort of coalitions
that we
make
need.
Sense, that we need to help anchor stability in critical parts of the world.
Yeah. If those guys could get together, it's good for the United States. It's in our interest.
To be sure.
It's in their interest. It's our interest.
Exactly right.
Let me just close with the following question. So civ-military relations. So you spent in the last later part of your career, you really spent a lot. You've been very active with the U.S. Global Leadership Campaign. Thank you for that. It's very important in my mind to have generals of your reputation and your career trajectory involved in the U.S. Global Leadership Campaign, because it's far more credible when generals talk about this stuff than the hippies.
Sure.
When a senior military person says it's important, it really has a lot of credibility, as you know, General. So talk a little bit more about how could we have better civ-mil relations, because it seems to me you talked a little bit about it earlier in the conversation. How should we be thinking about relations between the Defense Department and AID, or the Defense Department and the State Department? How should we think about those things?
We've got to start with having increased understanding of the mission that each of us has so that we aren't scared by it. It's not something that we get frightened of or stay away from. And so the relationships that need to be in place, like in anything else, need to be in place. You have to have a cadre of folk.
So Ambassador Yates knew you and you trusted each
other. That's right. You build relationships.
Across the agencies.
Across agencies.
And that matters.
That matters. You exchange folks. And
we don't do that enough
in
our system.
We don't do that enough in our system.
No.
You know, a smart person is a smart person, but their level of understanding is based on where they are, what they know, where they come from.
What
they've been exposed to.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And so you have increased understanding when you exchange folks, you exchange the staff positions, you bring folks out of one culture to another so they understand, oh, I get this. Oh, this does work. Probably one of my early exposures to this was in Somalia. And I was a brigade commander in Somalia. And this is before the Black Hawk. Now, this is before things went kind of south.
This is like 91?
This was in 92 and early 93.
Okay.
And I went to visit one of my young... Well, I went to visit a part of the area that my brigade operated in.
Yeah.
And there was a young sergeant in that area. And so I get there and visiting with my sergeant, how things going, partner. He said, we're doing fine. But I met with the village chief or the elder, and he was asking me about some agricultural things he wanted to do. But these were things that we didn't do. Now, we were there. We had created, okay, it was safe. You know,
it was safe.
The technicals weren't running through the streets.
No. Nope.
Because we were there stopping that now. But now the point was made, well, now what do we do next? Well, the only person there was my young sergeant and his nine members of his squad, and they didn't do that, but they, some rudimentary things that they were trying to do, but the trained person that could help that tribal leader do things that would cause more stability in his village, that wasn't happening. And so it became very clear to me that when we engage in these sorts of things, we need partners. We need partners who bring to this environment, this setting, things that we don't do, but are vitally important to sustaining whatever stability that we have temporarily created. In order to sustain it over time, these other things need to be in place. So that's why the development component is so important. And for us as a nation to get better at that, we need to have these sorts of things that are integrated in operation so that when plans are made and are drawn up, a part of that process includes a discussion and the resourcing of these other things that need to be in place as well. And when you have staff members from Department of Agriculture, Commerce, Treasury, which we had in AFRICOM, in addition to USAID and Department of State, as well as some of the agencies. Then you get a mindset into input into the operation that has reflective of these other perspectives. And when that happens, that whole set is increased and enhanced because it's more effective, because it's a complete set. And it's not just this that gets done, but then there's a void because nothing else is happening. That something else that needs to be happening is present. That's what I saw in Bosnia, working with the Patty Ashdown in the EU. That's what I saw in Israel, working with the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis when it came to what I was doing as a security chief and what I saw Jim Wolfenson doing as our economic lead on that side, as we work together, complementing each other's effort. And that's what I think needs to happen moving forward. And the best way for it to happen is when you have members from those respective disciplines a part of whatever entity we're talking about.
General, this is great. Thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your service.
Dan, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, sir.
Thanks, General.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.